Goscinny presents, in collaboration with Recto Verso, Gonzo Circus, and Collateral, Radical Murmur, a sonic exploration in three parts. Episode 1, The Sonic City. We live in a media era that is dominated by image and language. Yet sound often seems less important. Traschlini dives into the possibilities of the sonic dimension through conversations with makers and thinkers who take sound as a starting point. What can we learn about the world through listening? What are the political and artistic possibilities of sound? And how can sonic sensibility be of value for our thinking and acting? In three episodes, we explore this sonic world through interviews on location, in which the noise and buzz of the environment emphatically get enough space to make their voices be heard. In this first episode, The Sonic City, we investigate sonic practice within the urban environment. First of all, we take the train to Berlin to talk to thinker and artist Salome Voegelin. Voegelin wrote a number of groundbreaking books in the field of sound studies, including The Political Possibility of Sound and Sonic Possible Worlds. She is preeminently the person who can tell us more about sonic sensibility and what the political possibilities of sound are. We speak to her during the pandemic, while we take a now for many typical corona walk. Our walk immediately goes steeply uphill, which is why all three of us start breathing firmly.
So would you like me, now that we're a bit away from the trains, maybe say something about, introduce myself. So my name is Salome Voegelin. I am originally a Swiss, and then for a very long time now, 25, 27 years, resident in England, and now since 2 years or 1.5 years in Berlin. Sound artist, researcher, writer into sound as a material. I mean, there is an interest in sound art, an interest in music, of course, as well, and in so the materiality of sound, also the materiality of sound in the everyday, how we hear ourselves, how we move and behave and orientate ourselves in the everyday because of the sounds we hear, even though we might not even be aware of it. So as a kind of social, cultural studies, if you will, but also as a conceptual thinking art and thinking the everyday through sound, through its relationality, how sound is not this or that, but how it is always about relationships and in between spaces and in between times, that allows us, I feel, to rethink norms, habits, how we normally move, how we normally act and react. It just gives us sort of another layer in which to think about ourselves as subjects, as identities, and to think about the world and the environments as organized. They're always organized, they're always constructed, racially, gender, class, organizes the world differently. And sound, I'm so intrigued by it, or I love to work with it, because it allows us to step out a little bit of this visual preference and see another world, a sonic possible world through which we can reflect what we think we see and what we think we know. So I work on that sort of intrigue and excitement through writing, through work and teaching, and yeah, in all sorts of ways.
The briefing tells that we are making a considerable effort. We are in Volkspark Humboldtshain and climb one of the artificial mountains that were built there from the swept together scrap of the Second World War around two gigantic Nazi bunkers.
I think sound is such a relational medium. It's, you really want to do it together. You want to play music together. You want to make sounds together. You want to discuss sounds together. That's a real strong impulse for me.
Yeah, you want to hear and to be heard.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's about reciprocity. And it's not just about a one-way stream, but it's also not just about listening. It's about the exchange, because the sounds really are, and you can't see this on a radio program, but they're not over there and they're not with my body, but they're somewhere in this invisible space in between, and they're indivisible. We might think, well, you're a different person from me, and we're individuated shapes and forms, have nothing to do with each other. We stop with our skin. But as soon as we get into conversation, we become entangled, and our entanglement and codependence becomes apparent, and we are indivisible. The exclusion of sound in philosophical discourse, or in theory in general, and we're talking Western discourse here and Western philosophy, is not innocent. I mean, the Western thought is all about tidying up the world along lines of function, purpose to the human. Very anthropocentric, hence also this, the colonial grab, the kind of grabbing, taking and bringing into museums where it then gets ordered. Absolutely, behind glass cabinets, and it's a totally visual culture that is not just visual because it's just forgot about the sonic, but because the sonic, in its non-categorizability, in its non-linearity, it's in its diffuse geography and in its diffuse history, disturbs that ideology of clear individuation, clear identity. This country, not that country, this bird, not that bird, where it doesn't, for the visual to work as a philosophy, it needs to exclude that fuzzy, what it calls irrational indivisibility of sound. Because as soon as we think through whatever discipline you take, literature, geography, history, music, particularly music that really doesn't like sound, paradoxically speaking, because it likes organized sound, it likes a tone, it likes a categorizable, linguistically organizable sound, then you disturb the kind of fundamentals of science of that discipline and how it's been rationalized and its logic. And hidden behind that logic and rationality is, of course, a politics. It's a colonial politics. It's a politics of a knowledge that is supreme, that also perceives itself as universal, as a scientism. And so my interest in sound is because I think it holds an awful lot of alternative knowledge, of extra knowledge, of plural knowledge that we desperately need to actually solve problems like climate change and the health issues brought on by COVID. Because these are problems of indivisibility. These are problems of codependence and correlation, that we are one world, that is one cosmos, and everything somebody does on this side of the world will have an impact on this side. What you do has an impact on me. We're not individuated Western forms. We are entirely formless, and if we want to solve these problems, we need a sonic sensibility to at least play part, to at least be a collaborator in our thinking and knowledge production. I'm interested in sound because I understand it as a greater malaise, or its exclusion is an exclusion of everything that's off the line, everything that's not white, masculine, straight, Western thinking, all the fuzzy bits. And we can only get to those other things, or sound is one way, one portal, to get to those funny things and be able to bring them to and with, to pluralize knowledge, to have tacit knowledge, feminist knowledge, local knowledge, material knowledge, that can all start, maybe, if we could abandon the line, work together.
We have arrived at the top and are standing on one of the bunkers, a so-called Flakturm that was built for the anti-aircraft defenses and that now serves as a watchtower. This environment breathes Berlin's history. We ask Vogelin if there are sonic ways to approach urban history instead of the usual visual way.
Yeah, I find it interesting because you're still standing on this Flakturm.
Flakturm,
yeah. That's what it said downstairs.
Probably.
And so it's obviously a tower that was somehow built to look far away to see whether the enemy is coming. I imagine that's what it was built for, and it still has that sense. So we're standing here and we can actually see far into Pankow and beyond. And that is the kind of the visual cartography and the visual sensibility is about this sense of I am not involved in what I see. I can have an objective science, a science, because my body, my physical whatever does not influence what I see. So this is a huge fiction, a huge illusion. I mean, it's almost fantastical how the visual is completely built on an impossibility that my gaze is not involved also as a subjectivity in what I see, however at a distance I am. But I think it's built into this space that this space means I am not influencing. And that's why you can do cartography. You can draw lines on a piece of paper and call it a map and think you can get the measure of a country, or you can get the measure of an area, and authority and credibility comes out of that space, and evidence and an authority to evidence and reference, which is really interesting to me in terms of how knowledge is produced and how some knowledge can be made legitimate because we can evidence it, we can reference it, we can refer back to historically, oh, this person said this and this person said that. But then, of course, the question, particularly if I come from Masonic thinking, well, what if I'm not in history? What if my identity is not represented? What if history doesn't tell my story? How do I reference my contemporary at this moment reality? How do I evidence that I even exist now? And how could I write a paper without past references if the past references do not hold my knowledge? And that's kind of a really basic question of how we can decolonialize knowledge, because we'd really have to stop being, and this is particularly since I live in Germany, something I've realized, the Germans are extremely, the reference to the past and the doing of Wissenschaft as a scholarship of the past into the present is really, really essential here. You really get your legitimacy through that movement. And obviously decoloniality would mean that movement cannot be made, because if I'm not in history books, how can my knowledge of the present be truthful or right? I can't evidence it, I can't reference it. And again, I'm probably losing your question, but I think so, the closeness into which sound always and by necessity throws us. There is no distance. We're standing about COVID properly 1.5 meters apart, but of course we are not in sounds that apart. I really sense you. I think about your question. I hear your voice. I feel your voice. I have to deal with its full materiality and don't just answer the question semantically, but also the intonation, the sense I get from it and everything else. And that is far more complex. It's a far more complex way. But I think there's something held in that. There is something held in if we don't just refer back to a historical line. But then we can't make maps, and we have to rethink what history is, that we do it as histories at best, or maybe just very fuzzy stories, that the autobiographical has much more sway. My reality as an individual reality that then meets your reality in negotiation has to hold scholarly, scientific sway. Science has to become a matter of negotiation, particularly in the humanities, where we negotiate how we can speak about things and whose voice counts and what we can and how we can learn from each other rather than maybe from a historical moment. And so I think the closeness of sound just really challenges us in new ways, but because we can't physically, we can't remove ourselves, so we have to deal with that closeness and proximity as a methodology rather than as something we need to avoid.
From the high Flakturm, we look out over the city and ask Voegelin if there is danger in an impressive visual perspective like this. Does her plea for sonic sensibility also mean that there is too much visual sensibility? What could be wrong with a beautiful panoramic view such as this?
I like it. I like views. I have absolutely nothing against views. But it also always interests me, you know, we sort of, part of my maybe advocacy for sound studies is always, well, actually, you know, we have had already sound studies in the 60s and 70s. If you think of something like Michel Desserteaux and his book of, you know, the spatial practices, or the, where he goes to the World Trade Center and he discusses New York as seen from the World Trade Center and as seen by the walker down below. This kind of very seminal text. And to me, although of course he never mentions sound at all, but he mentions the blind walker, the person who walks in the streets, who makes a path, who can't see from one house to the next, because obviously in New York they're very high and you haven't got a horizon, as opposed to the, like we are now on top of this Flakturm, when you're high above and you can see, you have this, what he calls the godlike view. Yes. And this godlike view that suffuses also the notion of science as the those who know as being clearer to God. Yeah, that you are, there's a certain control implied. But it's nice because when you listen to this, obviously when you hear us talking and walking through this environment on the radio, you can't see what we see, this vista from afar, the control we have over the design of the place of Berlin looking northwards towards Pankow. All you get is this kind of really intense, a siren, a train in your ear, on your body, yeah.
Yes. And it's also interesting that in a sense it does mirror, which is a visual metaphor, which is a pity, but we're seeing in the sense that it's not a few sounds that make them out there, but it's everything. It's the simultaneous amalgam of all these different things happening and all these things that make sounds.
Exactly, and we can't order them, we can't organize them. The way we do now, I stand here and I see the cars are going right, the two police cars went right, there are cars going left. I have a mapped vision and I'm organizing the world, I'm ordering the world. And in sound, I can't do that. If it gets thrown to me by the radio, it's just like, oh my God, there's so much happening. But actually, it's exactly this disorder, this unorganized, this unmapped, that I think is a very interesting challenge for listening, to build your own way that these things connect, your own way you connect to the sound of police sirens or to an S-Bahn or to maybe you've been here before and so there is a memory that comes into play, whether you like the birds we're hearing as well or not. And you have to sort of make a contingent sense of all the things you hear together rather than being presented with how the world is.
Voegelin's passionate plea for sonic sensibility reverberates in our heads and blends into the city noise. According to Voegelin, sonic sensibility is a way of approaching the world that exposes the invisible movements beneath the surface of a visual world and thereby challenges the dominant position of that visual world. A view from a tall building may be beautiful, but this view carries with it the danger of the godlike view, a false appearance of overview, clarity and distance, which can make a person or even an entire culture feel seemingly objective, but actually superior. Sonic sensibility offers a counterbalance. The awareness of the complex polyphonic sonic world, from which we are not at an objective distance, but rather in the middle, makes the divine superior perspective impossible. In this way, we realize that we have to embrace this beautiful pluriform complexity, unlock this sonic dimension by listening, and thus come to other possible worlds, sonic possible worlds. We strain our ears and focus on this invisible space, the gigantic mass of sounds that moves around and through us. Slowly, the sonic possible worlds begin to dawn on us. We stay a little bit longer in Berlin. We get on a metro to meet field recordist and musician Peter Cusack in a so-called Hinterhof in the Spandauer Vorstadt. Cusack started the Favorite Sounds project in 1998, which investigates what people find positive about the soundscapes of the places where they live. The project has taken place worldwide in London, Beijing, Prague, Manchester, Berlin and Hull, among others. His other long-term project, Sounds from Dangerous Places, which he describes as sonic journalism, investigates the soundscapes of places where ecological catastrophes have occurred, such as Chernobyl, the Caspian oil fields, and the Białowieża forest in Poland.
Liebe Fahrgäste, im ÖPNV gilt die 3G-Regel. Beachten Sie die gesetzlichen Regelungen zur Maskenpflicht. Wir empfehlen das Tragen einer FFP2-Maske. Vielen Dank.
My name is Peter Cusack. I'm a field recordist and a musician and sometimes a sound artist and also a teacher, lecturer in sound. I do have done many projects over the years to do with mine and human relationships with our sound environment, both in urban and rural and in distant lands. Well, we are in the center of Berlin, Berlin Mitte, and outside the Father Carpenter Cafe, and that is inside a Berlin Hinterhof, a kind of courtyard, which is a very big part of Berlin architecture. The courtyards are usually surrounded on all sides by buildings, and maybe there's an entrance, as here, an archway out to the street, but sometimes there's even a door protecting that. So it's a kind of architecture which prevents the city noise coming in inside the courtyards, and so they're much quieter. But because they're surrounded by buildings, they also are rather reverberant. Mm. So if I clap my hands, you hear the reverberation of that sound rather easily. And that, of course, depends on how big it is and how high the buildings are and whether it's a hard surface. Many Berlin Hinterhofs have actually a garden inside, so there are trees and grass and often birds singing. But this has some ornamental garden, but nothing wild or particularly large. In Berlin is a young city compared to most capital cities in Europe. It was built at the end of the 19th century. At that time, it was not an industrial city. Well, it never has been. But there is a lot of small industry, and so the Hinterhof used to be places where people would live, and then they would have their small workplace on the ground, or maybe even keep animals. So maybe at the beginning of the last century, these places were full of noise, working noise, and people would live on the higher stories. Today, all that's changed. Now most of them have become entirely residential. But in the center of the city, as we are now, those workplaces have become cafes or restaurants or IT companies or, you know, the usual new industries, which of course are much quieter than a blacksmith or a cleaning factory. So they're relatively quiet. And you can hear the birds singing. Here we have a pigeon calling almost constantly. It's coming on for springtime, so they're already busy looking for mates and marking out nesting places. And that's what you can hear. Pigeons are very common in Berlin Hinterhof. And the other main sound is the traffic noise coming in from the streets, but that again is rather quiet.
What is your favorite sound of the city you live in and why? It's the question that Peter Cusack has been asking city dwellers since 1998 as part of his Favorite Sounds project. He himself writes about this. It is a simple question to ask, but it is not so easy to answer. It is an attempt to discover what we find positive about and how we interact with the sounds of the cities and neighborhoods in which we live and work. The answers were fascinating, both on an individual level and the global patterns that emerge from the whole. They show the city of the ear, rather than that of the eye, and emphasize all the roles that sound plays in everyday life. Activating memories, the associations with other thoughts, initiating actions, giving pleasure, and the constant information that sound gives about the events that happen around us. We ask Cusack if Berlin has a unique sound compared to other cities of similar size.
Yes, I think all cities have a unique sound, in fact. I mean, what that actually is and the reasons for it are often very complicated. And it's to do with the transport infrastructure and the styles of architecture, how much green space, how high or low the buildings are, and then also the geographical location. If you compare Berlin with an Italian city, for example, the weather there is much warmer generally, and therefore the wildlife, they're kind of constantly insects chirping in Italy. You don't hear that. You hear that in the summer in Berlin. Also, the people's kind of style of behavior is different from one country to another. In Italy, again, they're very keen on going for a walk around in the end of the afternoon, early evening, kind of promenading around. You don't do that in Berlin. It's too cold. So the geographical position has a huge difference on the wildlife and on how people behave and on the styles of architecture, because again, the more north you go, the architecture has to be built for the winter in a way that in southern Europe it's not necessary. All that makes a big difference to how a place sounds.
During this meeting with Cusack, it becomes clear what Voegelin's sonic sensibility can mean. The sensitivity to and knowledge about the surrounding sound world that Cusack exhibits is inspiring and impressive. The Flakturm and now this Hinterhof. Everything in Berlin seems to breathe history. Berlin has regularly been the scene of important events in European history in the 20th century. Are there historical traces to be found in the sound of the city?
Yes, I would say for sure. For example, Berlin was a divided city from the end of the Second World War until 1989. So there was a lot of development which still exists that happened when it was East Berlin or West Berlin, when they were separate. And you can hear that. For example, in East Berlin, they use paving stones, which are bigger than in West Berlin. So, and some of those areas still exist. So if you drag a suitcase with wheels across, the rhythm is different in East Berlin compared to West Berlin. Mm. Also, different people came. In West Berlin and West Germany in general, the guest workers were mostly Turkish or Greek.
And in the East, yes.
And in the East it was Vietnamese. So again, that still is it's beginning to mix up much more now, but you still find more Vietnamese language spoken in the East than in the West, and more Turkish in former West. There are more trams in former East. So yes, there are quite a lot of, they're small things, but they make, when you add them together, a noticeable difference. Yeah, I mean, Berlin's unique. Most modern cities have a very unclear dividing line at the point where the city ends. They sprawl for many kilometers through suburbs and then... But Berlin, actually, because of its history, has very sharp points where it's the city ends and the countryside starts. And actually, you can find those in both East and West. But that is something that makes Berlin slightly different from other European cities.
The sort of parts break between urban and rural.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's beginning to change. But the East German planning regulations were much tighter about where you could build and where you could not build. But in West Berlin, there was a border. So, of course, they couldn't build outside the border. So, for different reasons, there was quite a kind of sharp end to the city on that side as well. But Berlin has no high buildings. I mean, there are one or two. But compared to London or Paris or Brussels, the height of the buildings in Berlin is quite low. That makes a difference to the way the acoustics works. It makes a difference to the way the wind blows through the city, which has an effect on the soundscape.
What makes Berlin sound particularly Berlin? Is it more subdued?
No, I think Berlin is certainly quieter than Brussels. In Brussels you hear many sirens a lot of the time. Of course you hear them in Berlin also, but not nearly as much. Berlin does not have so many aircraft flying over. Brussels has a lot. London is constantly covered with air. Well, until the pandemic, it was constantly covered with aeroplanes. So Paris has much less green space. Berlin has a lot of green space. So it's actually full of wildlife. Non-human presence is quite high in Berlin compared to other cities. There are particularly unique things in Berlin. For example, the S-Bahn railway system has a very special sound. And because it's very extensive, it was actually during the time of East Germany, it was run by the East Germans, even though it operates also in West Berlin. it's very extensive, and wherever you are in Berlin, you hear the S-Bahn, and that has a really or rising tones. This is quite a musical contribution to Berlin's soundscape, which is totally unique to Berlin. Oh, Berlin is also the nightingale capital of Europe.
Is it?
So there are many nightingales that you hear at the right time of year, which is kind of April, May, singing in Berlin, maybe 3,000.
Wow.
All European capitals have a few, but Berlin has many. So at that time of year, whenever you walk out, particularly at night, you hear these fantastic songbirds. Another common favourite sound is the sound of different green spaces like parks or gardens or cemeteries. So in the Favourite Sounds project, the two biggest categories in most cities are either green spaces or public transport sounds, but then there are many others as well.
Normally the quieter sounds, or rather
Not at all. Some people often like loud sounds, particularly loud sounds on that are short. I mean, there are people that like traffic noise. I was surprised to find that, but it is so. So you can never tell, everybody is different.
Right.
And so the idea that you would find a popular sound and then have much of that and everybody would be happy is total nonsense.
Right. That's the wish of city planners.
Yes, that's right. I mean, for me, the way that project translates into planning ideas is that you need as big a variety of sounds as possible. And everybody will find some to hate, everybody will find some to like. And that would be my aim, which is a shame, because normally planning now tries to make everything conform to the same few standards, and that makes everything boring.
Hmm. Right. Yeah. Would you be able to tell from a field recording if it's in a redevelopment area with lots of new buildings because of these sound measures that are being imposed everywhere and are the same everywhere?
Not really. I don't think just by listening to a recording you'd be able to tell that there was a difference, but you wouldn't necessarily be able to be accurate about it just from the sound. I mean, the way we perceive things is that, I mean, right now we're just talking about sound, but in fact our eyes are working, all our senses are working. So we don't only hear, we see what we hear what we see, smell, the temperature, all of that. Here's an S-Bahn. Here it has a kind of tone to it, which is quite nice.
It is.
And when it slows down, that goes downwards, and when it speeds up, the tone rises, so it kind of has a glissando. No, I mean, our senses all work together, so it, really it's quite false to concentrate only on sound or only on vision. This is another S-Bahn. And so it's hard to separate the information, because in normal life we do not. We need all, our perception is from all the senses all of the time. So you can't necessarily get all the information just by listening or just by seeing or just by anything. You need together.
We travel to the Netherlands. In The Hague, we meet artist Justin Bennett inside the building complex New Babylon, next to the central station. Bennett has set up the audio project Radio New Babylon within and around his building. New Babylon is named after the brainchild of artist Constant Nieuwenhuis, a utopian anti-capitalist city where the homo ludens, the playing man, is central. In this city of Nieuwenhuis, people have the freedom to play and create, because automation has made conventional labor superfluous. However, the New Babylon complex where we meet Bennett certainly does not breathe an anti-capitalist atmosphere.
So I'm Justin Bennett. I live in Den Haag, in the Netherlands. That's where we are now. And I'm an artist, I guess. I work with sound and image in different ways. And I'm very interested in the, in cities and in architecture, and in the way that the sound of our environment in the cities, how it affects us and our life, and how people behave and that kind of thing. And now we're in New Babylon, which is it's a kind of office and residential complex next to the central station. And we're on the ground floor, which is really the only publicly accessible part of the space. It's not a public space, but it's we can walk through it. It's mostly empty at the moment. There are one or two shops, but I think, as you can hear, it's quite a quiet place, really.
The sounds are very low.
Especially in this position, because you can hear people coming and going, and it sort of moves through the space in an interesting way.
What's the precise history of the building again? Was it a sort of a story of failure and vacant spaces?
When I first moved to The Hague, it was quite a busy place, because it was the place you went to from Central Station to have something to eat or have coffee or something. So it was kind of that proximity to the station made it quite lively. But I think it was always troubled. If you look at the history of the building, it's been sold and bought many, many times, and sometimes for not much money, you know. So it's been kind of shoved between investment vehicles, taken over by the state and then sold off again, and all this kind of thing. And it's been going on and on for a long time.
And then now it's in private hands?
Now it's in private hands. It's actually, at the moment, I think, owned by a Danish pension fund. Uh-huh. It was originally offices, and now I think you can see, if we look up there, that is the apartment block, I think, that you can see towering above us. And there's another tower here, which is offices. So the only public space, I mean, it's not even a public space, but this sort of public space we're in, is just the ground floor. When the renovation first took place, there were cafes and restaurants and shops on two floors. But quite a lot of the people, they left because the rents were too high, basically. Ah. So it was, I don't know. There was a lot of protest from the people there. I find it quite an interesting space, just as an empty space, because it has an interesting acoustic, I think. It's very reverberant, really, because of these glass walls. And it's quite quiet. And you also have these visual reflections. So visually, it's quite strong. I mean, it's not my favorite sort of architecture, and it could be a bit kitschy or something, but actually these circles, they work really well as a kind of visual element that goes through the building. So I don't think it's all disastrous or negative, but it's just mostly the kind of idea about it being to think about it as being a kind of the end result of constant Neuenhaus's trajectory through New Babylon. And it ends up as this. Of course, they would say, no, it used to be called Babylon, this building. And so it has nothing to do with Constant Neuenhaus, it's just the new Babylon.
But even
right.
Babylon is quite weird and sort of almost a setup for failure, one could say, to name your fancy new glossy office block Babylon.
Yeah.
The tower that is famous because it was torn down, basically.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. When it was first built, actually, there were already people in the press making references to Constant Neuenhaus's project. So they were calling this the Whore of Babylon or something. So this was seen as a kind of capitalist appropriation of his project already back in 1970. It was Paul Donker Davis wrote an article in the, can't remember which newspaper, about it. So.
Can you tell us a little bit about the project, about Radio New Babylon?
I was looking at public spaces and art in public space, and I was really interested in spaces which are kind of what they call POPs, so privately owned public spaces, and what you could and what you couldn't do there. You know, this is a case in point because we're not actually supposed to be recording here. Mm. You're not allowed to film or record, or I'm surprised we've got away with it this long. So the idea was, how could we do something in a space like this in a kind of secret way, but it, which let people have some kind of experience of artworks or music works. And I was already working with these kind of app-based augmented reality almost, but audio apps where you can locate audio in particular places and let the listener move through those spaces and listen to things. It's like a spatial composition idea in a way. I thought, well, it would be interesting to make some pieces for this place. And then I thought, why should I do that? I mean, it was something like, I'm not interested in doing it myself, really. I was more interested in how other people would respond. Also because of this kind of mismatch between the idea of New Babylon being a city of play and this place, which is where you can't play, really. So it was, I thought, well, I'm just going to invite people who I know knew the building as well, so people from The Hague, but also different sound artists I knew, also international people. And I just asked them to make a short, if they feel like it, if you feel like it, make a short piece and send it to me, and I'll place it, and then we'll have this kind of, it's like an album, actually. It's kind of like an album, but you have to be here to listen to it. Some people really did. Some people came here actually and made recordings and then did things with the recordings. And other people did something somewhere completely different and just put that there. Some people were more playful with the kind of composition method. So there are some people who've really played with locating different sounds in different places on different sides of the building. Most people just made a piece that, yeah, you could listen to it either inside or around, depending on what you want to do. If you want to be warm or you want to have fresh air. But it's grown to, like, there are now about 30 pieces, and there are still some people making things.
In Bennett's earlier works, such as the Zuidas Symphony, the relationship between private and public property also plays an important role. We ask him if this is a theme that comes back more often in his work.
As an artist, if you're confronted with this kind of thing anyway in your work, when you're asked to do things or invited to do things in certain places, then you come across these the restrictions or the differences between where you're allowed to do certain things and who you have to deal with. And I'm also really interested in this idea of who is the city for, or who are buildings for, and who makes decisions about that.
Maybe a bit of a sidetrack, but did Constant Nieuwenhuis's ideas, theories, and plans about New Babylon, did they have a sonic component as well?
They did.
Okay.
And he was, I was reading a long time ago about him doing his presentations, and he would, it would always said, yeah, that he did these lectures with slideshows and played soundtracks, but it was never clear what these soundtracks were. Then suddenly there was this moment, this last year, when I was doing this research into Constant Nieuwenhuis, and I had contact with the Fondation Constant. And by chance, they said, well, I think I asked about this. Like, and they said, well, we don't really know, but we've got some tapes lying around here and we don't know what they are. So I said, I'll have a look at them. So I borrowed these tapes and we digitized them at the Institute of Sonology, where I work. And they're super interesting because some of it is not quite clear what it is. Seems to be material to make something with rather than finished pieces, but some of it is clearly a kind of finished long collage. So it's a collage of city sounds, music, voices, some kind of simple tape manipulation, you know, very, very speed and playing things backwards. And yeah, it was really interesting to discover that. Also because you had an idea of this city, it's incredibly noisy. He also talks about the ambiences would be controlled and played with by creative teams, he says.
Oh, really?
I guess to encourage people to play. So he had a kind of, there was a role in New Babylon for people actually making not just sound but also visual art and I mean, it wasn't art anymore by this point. It was about controlling the ambiences of the city, I think, rather than being a kind of autonomous artwork, it would be part of the ambience of the whole city. But when you listen to these collages, it's like, yeah, car crashes and free jazz and some backwards, you know, I don't know, some backwards comedian talking, and there's all this kind of weird stuff, lots of machine noises.
Not all harmonic.
Not at all. Yeah, it's much more improvised. His sound world is much more kind of improvisatory and chaotic and open in a way that I think he wanted his city to be, you know. I'm not sure it would be a nice place to live. If you listen to that, you might think, Jesus, I don't want to, you know, I don't really want to be there. But I think that's really interesting also to think about the links between how people relate to each other in music, and especially with improvised music, and how people relate to each other socially and politically. It's something that's really interesting, I think.
We leave New Babylon to take a walk through the center of The Hague.
I'm always surprised if you look at, about 10 or 15 years ago, every large European city had to make a noise map if it was above a certain population. It was something the gemeentes, they all had to do this. And if you look at the one of Den Haag, then, I guess every city is kind of the same. You tend to think of, okay, the center of town is kind of busy and it must be noisy, but there's often right in the center places where it's actually really quiet, and you can see that. I mean, these noise maps are usually not measured, they're just calculated. So they see where the traffic is, how the traffic moves and the times of day and that kind of thing, and they sort of calculate it. But it's true that right in the center of The Hague, there are places which are really like oase, you know, oasis. It sees oases in the soundscape. We could walk down that way because this is quite an interesting acoustic down here. Even before those really big buildings were built, people would complain about the wind here.
Oh, really?
This kind of tunnel. I'm trying to remember what they call it. They have some kind of over-the-top name for this entrance to the city. When you come from Central Station and you walk into the city, yeah, well, it's something like that, you know. It's a windgat, basically. It's a wind tunnel that you get stuck in. And now it's even worse with these buildings. I guess this is in a way why I got into listening to cities and doing things with recording cities, is that when I first started making my own music, I guess, then I made a lot of recordings in the city simply because it was the easiest way to get interesting sounds. I didn't have any complicated synthesizers or computers or anything, so it was like cassette recorders and tape recorders, and so it was kind of like sound collecting, and especially these kind of industrial sounds, drones and machines and this kind of thing. I made loads of recordings of that, and I think that's probably how I got interested in really listening to the city, listening to it first as a kind of source of musical material.
Now, how's it different now?
Well, it's similar. It's the same, because I still also listen to things as musical material. But I think I've come to. I think you go through different, because there's so many different ways of listening. And I think at least as an artist or a musician working with these kinds of sounds, you also go through different kinds of ways of working with it. You know, so I think. I started off, yeah, looking for material to do things with, or to sample, or to work with, and then I became more interested in the kind of longer term listening and longer recording. So listening to the rhythms, how a city changes in across a whole day, or that kind of thing. And then I get interested in, yeah, the sound of spaces, you know, listening to sounds as, how sound reveals space. When the tram goes ding here, you know, it echoes in a particular way. And
sirens fitted to the emergency vehicles in Brussels have always been clearly present in the sonic environment. But since the recent terrorist attacks, their presence is almost ubiquitous. Like the calls of a bird or other territorial animal, the sirens proclaim, "I am here. This street is mine." Of course, this is exactly the intention, a proclamation of the ownership of, or the right to use, the roadway above any other user. In claiming the street, though, they perform a double territorialization by also dominating a large portion of the sonic spectrum. The sirens, especially those that sweep up and down in frequency, cover a large part of our functional hearing range, particularly that which we use for listening to speech. The sweeps start usually at about 500 to 600 Hz in order for them to be heard clearly above the rumble of traffic. The upper fundamental frequency is usually about 1500 Hz, but the harmonics or overtones audible when in line of sight of the vehicle go up to about 8000 Hz. The volume that the sirens produce, 110 decibels, measured at 3.5 meter in front of the vehicle, is apparently necessary to allow them to be heard over in-car sound systems.
This was an excerpt from Bennett's Siren Song publication. This work explores the place of sirens in the sonic environment through text and image. What is striking in Bennett's work is that sound is approached both musically and politically. Sometimes one of the two, sometimes both at the same time.
Like I said, you can listen in different ways as well. So these different modes of listening to a sound as being a siren, you can listen to it as a musical thing, or you can listen to it as a way of hearing the architecture of a place, but you can also hear it as what it's supposed to be, which is get out of the way. Get out of the way, there's an ambulance coming. Or you can listen to it as the sign, a kind of symbolically as you know, the police are again going down to the park to get rid of all the homeless people there or something. So, you know, it works on all these different levels. And I definitely like to play with these different levels and go. I'm interested in all of them, I suppose. I'm interested in too many things. And so I kind of move between them. And sometimes, it's sometimes I also just like to make music, actually. So it goes, you know, between these, this sort of journalistic or documentary approach is really interesting, and I do work with that as well. But sometimes I can kind of switch into this musical mode, which I think is also a very interesting way of listening, because it's perhaps a more, I don't know, it's not really distanced, but it's a more non-judgmental, perhaps, way of listening to the sounds around you, because you're listening in a completely different way, in an abstract way, instead of them being signs for something else, or something that annoys you because it stops you hearing something else, or you know, that kind of thing. It's, yeah, but it's something that I'm always thinking about, and I don't know where I put myself
right.
in that.
And it so, depends on the work.
It depends on the work, and it depends on, you know, different things. I tend to work on in kind of projects that take a longer time, and where different things come out of different works or events or whatever they are come out of that. So for instance, that thing in Brussels, that siren song that you mentioned, was at the same time as also creating a sound walk in Brussels and doing this project with the filters, so that these objects to listen through to the city, which in a way is more musical to my imagine, you know, I imagine that as being a kind of more musical thing in a way.
With Justin Bennett's acoustic filters, we've come to the end of this first episode of Radical Murmur, The Sonic City. The next episode is Resonances of Loss. Radical Murmur is a production by Trashlini in collaboration with Recto Verso, Gonzo Circus, and Collateral. Trashlini is Sjoerd Leijten and Roel Gifjoen.